This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we go into the second hour of the show. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Henry Frain at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be talking about the kind of reorganization of the government that came in response to the terrorist attacks of September 11th. And so what we're talking about here is the branch of government that came to be known as the Department of Homeland Security. It was officially established in the fall of 2002, but did not then officially begin operations until January of the following year. So this was January of 2003. There was some controversy surrounding its organization and creation. And this morning, we'll try to ask some basic questions about our response to terrorism and how well the Department of Homeland Security has done its job. And our guest for the program is Clark Irvin. He served as the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security, in fact, the very first one that it had. He became the Acting Inspector General on January 24th, 2003, when the Department of Homeland Security officially began operations. He was appointed. It was a recess appointment, actually, by President Bush. It came in December of 2003. His appointment expired in December of 2004. Before his service at the Department of Homeland Security, he was the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of State and the Broadcasting Board of Governors. That was from August 2001 until January of 2003. He also held a number of posts in state government, in the government of Texas. He's joining us this morning by telephone. He is currently at the Aspen Institute, where he is director of their recently established Institute for Homeland Security Initiative. So as we talk here this morning, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. By the way, I also do want to mention that our guest, Clark Irvin, is the author of a book that looks at this subject that we're talking about here this morning. The title of the book is Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and it was published in May, last May of 2006. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you want to read it. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Irvin, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Let me ask you as a very broad general question, and I'm sure that we'll get into some specifics because I want to talk about some of the various points that you address. You have addressed, certainly, in pieces that you've written and you address in this book. But as a general sort of question, would you say that are we now having created the Department of Homeland Security and brought together the kinds of functions under that umbrella, has that contributed to our security? Are we indeed better off than we were before September 11th, 2001?
We are better off, and the Department of Homeland Security, to be fair, has had something to do with that. But it seems to me, really, David, the question isn't whether we're better off, because it would be very difficult not to be somewhat better off given how bad off we were on 9/11. But the question should be whether we're as safe as we can be, whether we're as safe as we need to be, and whether we're as safe as we think we are all these many years after 9/11 and after the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. And sadly for the country, the answer to those questions is no. I could give you just a quick example mm-hmm. in the aviation context. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to cite the aviation context because we've done more there than anywhere else. Even though we've spent somewhere between $15 to $20 billion since 9/11 to secure ourselves in the aviation sector, and as a result of it, screeners are somewhat better trained. We have significantly more air marshals. Cockpit doors are hardened, and some pilots are armed now. It is still the case that time after time, my old office, the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security, TSA testers themselves, and the GAO, the Congressional Investigative Arm, are able to sneak guns and knives and bombs undetected through the screener checkpoints all the time. So Again, even where we've spent the most time and money, we're far more vulnerable than we need to be.
Well, you know, let me ask you about that. And I want to talk about some of these other areas because there are other things which are of great concern, things like what is happening at ports, what's happening at our borders. I know you have concerns about things like mass transit. But let's, for a moment, let's just stick with the kind of screening that we do now for people who are getting on commercial airplanes. And
sure.
This is something where we have, as you say, we put a lot of effort into this. We have spent a lot of money on this. We have hired additional people, and anybody who has traveled in the years since 9/11 and compare that to what it was before, you know that there is a more aggressive screening than existed before of people and of baggage.
Right.
But having said all that, as you say, it's true that from various times people have tested. They have just tried to poke the system and see, you know, what could you get away with as a way of testing the system, and that there still seem to be holes. And I guess the question that comes is that given all the time, thought, and resources we put into just this one feature, why is it that it doesn't perform better and that we still see it's possible for people to take weapons aboard airplanes?
Well, it's really a combination of things. Part of it is training. You know, one of the things that we recommended when I was the Inspector General 3 years ago when we did our first tests of airport security was that screeners be tested and trained on a regular basis. Back then, there was no requirement that there be recurrent training on screeners' part. So they'd get some initial training once they were hired, but they'd never be trained again. So it wasn't surprising to us that they did as poorly as they did back then on these tests. Since then, there is a training requirement. I believe that it's 40 hours over the course of a month. But all too often, we have found, at least anecdotally, that the screeners actually don't get that much training. And in fact, in certain cases, it's been alleged, and I believe this, that screeners have been pressured by TSA to claim that they have gotten the testing that they're supposed to have, when in fact they have not. So that's one thing. Screeners should be trained and tested on a regular basis. And indeed, those screeners who consistently fail to perform should ultimately be fired for it. And likewise, their supervisor should be held to account when, over time, it is proved that they are incapable of seeing to it that the screeners in their employ perform to optimal levels, point one. But it's also a question of technology. Just to give you one example, there are a number of technologies out there that would get us as close to 100% security as it's possible to be in this world. And yet, even though the Department of Homeland Security, TSA, knows about these technologies and has known about them for years, all too often they haven't been widely deployed. For example, the one that I'm keenest on is called backscatter technology, and you and your listeners may be familiar with it. Basically, it's a sophisticated X-ray machine, and this can see through clothing. So if you are a terrorist and you've got a gun or a knife hidden on your body, it doesn't really do anything for explosives, but if you've got metal, gun or knife on your body, it can see through your clothing to see where that gun and knife is hidden. And yet, of course, there are privacy concerns with that, but those privacy concerns can be mitigated by transmuting the bodily image into a cartoon stick figure, and also the viewing can be done at some remove from the screening checkpoint, even though this can be done in a way that is protective of privacy, and even though, as I say, it's foolproof as far as detecting guns and knives, this is still in the testing phase at just a handful of airports around the country. This technology should be available at every checkpoint in every airport in this country. Now, that's a question of resources, but that's another problem. The Department of Homeland Security has been under-resourced from the beginning, and I say that as a Republican and as a conservative Republican who typically does not call for greater government spending. There are certain things that can be done on the cheap, but Homeland Security is not one of them.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about this concern about the possibility that people might carry explosives on their person onto the plane. People will remember this past summer there was this concern about this potential plot coming out of England where people might be carrying liquids that could be combined to make explosives, and that's why it was suddenly you couldn't bring liquids onto the plane. We have seen examples of suicide bombers getting onto planes wearing bombs and
yes.
Blowing themselves up and taking the plane down. So we check for explosives on check baggage, but we're not checking for explosives that people might actually be carrying on their person. And I think that there is some concern that that's a potential problem. Do you see that as a problem, and what are we doing to try to address that?
It certainly is a problem. There is no question but that we need to check for traces of explosives, not just on checked baggage, as you say, but also carry-on baggage and also on passengers' persons, on their bodies. With regard to carry-on baggage and with regard to passengers' bodies, that is not widely done. That checking is not widely done. It is only sporadically done. There are these explosive trace detection machines that are available at some checkpoints, at some airports, that are supposed to be able to detect trace explosives on carry-on baggage. And there are what are called puffer machines at certain airports. I live in Washington, D.C. There's one or several, anyway, at both of our airports in the Washington, D.C. area that can detect trace of explosives on passengers. But again, neither technology is widely deployed. And that is a vulnerability that's waiting to literally blow up in our faces one day.
Mm-hmm. This is something where certainly there is concern, and I think that everybody's concerned about it, passengers, government, airlines. But there does seem to be this big question about who's going to pay for this. Airlines are having a difficult time. They don't think that they should have to pay for it. But it seemed that there were some people in government that don't think that government should have to pay for it. There seems to be a big question here about, yes, they're technologies that we know that we can do. I mean, it's not that we don't have the technical expertise, but to implement them would mean spending some significant amount of money, and no one seems to want to open up their wallet and actually pay for it.
That's exactly right. You know, essentially, the budget of the Department of Homeland Security was at the beginning in 2003 and remains today, 4 years later. Essentially, the sum of the budgets of its 22 different components plus $125 million or so. And in Washington, $125 million isn't even a rounding error. The government loses that much money probably every minute or so or over a short period of time. So we need significantly more money. You know, we spend $400 to $500 billion on our defense budget to protect us from external threats, from nation states, and et cetera. But only a fraction of that, $30 to $40 billion, for the Department of Homeland Security. I don't pretend to have a precise figure in my mind as to what the budget of the Department of Homeland Security should be, but it should be closer, frankly, to $400 to $500 billion than to $30 to $40 billion. And we all know that if, God forbid, there were another terrorist attack tomorrow, there would be significantly greater spending for Homeland Security. The question is, can we take the steps right now that we know we need to take in the absence of another terror attack? I would have thought that 9/11 itself would have been all the motivation the nation needs to do everything that's necessary to make us as safe as possible. And yet, here we are, more than 5 years now after 9/11, and we're still, as I say, far more vulnerable than we need to be.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, after this concern about the people carrying these liquid explosives onto planes this past summer, I seem to recall having read some press about it suggesting that perhaps the concern was over-exaggerated or raising questions about whether, in fact, such a thing was even possible. Was that a real threat, do you think?
It was a very real threat. You know, I am not one to take everything that the Department of Homeland Security says at face value, quite the opposite, really. But I do believe Secretary Chertoff when he said that this really was the most serious threat to the nation, terrorist-wise, since 9/11. We dodged a bullet, and we did so, really, entirely thanks to the work of British intelligence and law enforcement officials. That plot was not foiled by the Department of Homeland Security. I will say that the Department of Homeland Security reacted to it very quickly and very adroitly by banning the liquids and gels literally overnight. But it was really more of a bad news story than a good news story. And what I mean by that is that we in the United States government, have known at least since 1994, 12 years, going on 13 years, about the vulnerability of aircraft to liquid explosives, because arch terrorist Ramzi Youssef, one of the masterminds of 9/11, used liquid explosives successfully on a flight through the Philippines that year in preparation for a plot that he had hatched next year, 1995, to blow up multiple jetliners over the Pacific. He killed one man on that flight using liquid explosives as a test. Fortunately, the plot didn't come off in 1995, but that was the plan. And so we should have been working, we, the United States government, over time, all those years, to develop counter technologies to liquid explosives, and yet we didn't have any counter technology. And so when this plot happened last summer, the only thing TSA could do was to go to the draconian step of banning all liquids and gels. It was a very serious threat. We still don't have a counter technology to it, and yet, as we all know, the department has relaxed the ban to some degree. And I think, frankly, that has the relaxation has more to do with pressure from business travelers, from the airline industry, a desire to make it more convenient for air travelers than any conviction now on the department's part that the threat is less serious than it was first thought to be.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, there are other countries where the kind of security that people have to go through when they travel is much more stringent than in the United States, even more stringent than it is now, which is more stringent than it was before September 11th. Do you think that we are indeed, in a sense, I suppose you've already answered this question, we're compromising our security in order to get some reasonable level of ease and comfort and expediency getting people onto airplanes?
Absolutely. No question about it. As you noted earlier, David, the airline industry is in grave trouble. They're doing better now than they were, of course, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, but profit margins are still very thin. Most of the airlines, if not all of them, are still unprofitable. There continues to be merger talk because of that. And so the airlines pressure TSA and the Department of Homeland Security to relax as many of these security measures as possible. And I think all too often the department has responded to that. For example, as you know and as many of your listeners know, there is now a relaxation on the liquid and gel ban such that one can't bring certain quantities, large quantities of these liquids and gels from home, and you can't buy them before you reach the screening checkpoint at stores in the airport. But you can buy them and take them onto the airplane with you if you buy them past the checkpoint at airport stores. Now, if in fact it's the case, as the Department of Homeland Security, TSA, maintained last summer, that the fear is that even minimal quantities of liquids and gels can be combined by terrorists once on board aircraft to create deadly liquid explosives, then what difference does it make whether you've brought the liquids and gels with you from home or if you've subsequently purchased them in the airport past the checkpoint? Seems to me the only difference is that if you purchase them, the liquids and gels, at the airport, then that's money in the pocket of the airports and ultimately in the pocket of the airline industry because it leads more people to travel. It's more convenient for them to travel. So this is just one example of many that I could cite to you as to relaxation of measures that the Department of Homeland Security done, not because of any security reason, I believe, but instead because of business pressures.
Our guest is Clark Irvin. He is director of the Homeland Security Initiative at the Aspen Institute, and he also served as the first Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. He took over in that capacity on the department's very first day, January 24th, 2003, and his appointment ran until December of 2004. He's the author of the book Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan, and it came out in May. Past May. So if you'd like to read on the subject, you certainly can. Questions, comments here are welcome too. As always, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Passenger airlines, I don't think that they carry a lot of cargo, but they do carry some. Is that being screened for explosives now?
It is not, David, and that's a huge vulnerability. Most Americans probably don't know that. They just assume, I believe, that air cargo, to the extent they think about air cargo at all, they probably assume that it's being screened like passenger luggage. But that's not the case. What's supposed to happen now is that if there's specific intelligence that the airlines have been made aware of indicating that a particular cargo container on an aircraft should be opened, then that package is supposed to be open, and also there are supposed to be random inspections conducted randomly by the airlines. But whether any of that happens, we don't know, because believe it or not, any inspections that are not done by the government, not done by TSA, but they're done by the airlines. And the airlines are not required by TSA to report whether they've done those inspections, so we really don't know. The bad news is, and again, most Americans don't realize this, about a fifth, about 20% of the cargo, I'm not talking about luggage, but cargo that goes on aircraft in this country goes on passenger aircraft as opposed to dedicated air cargo planes like DHL or Federal Express. So since Americans of all socioeconomic levels nowadays travel all the time on airplanes, what that means is the average American at one time or another has surely been on an airplane in the cargo hold of which is some cargo that is highly unlikely to have been screened for explosives beforehand. So again, that is a disaster waiting to happen. Terrorists know about this vulnerability. It is shocking to me that they have yet to exploit it, and I think we can only thank God for that.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's take them in the order they came in. First, someone in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. Just a quick question. I do a lot of flying, and I guess the real question would be, what is the point of screening passengers if the airlines can't prevent theft from luggage already? I mean, if you can steal something out of luggage, certainly you could put something back in. And don't you think that this is still a continuing problem? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, yes, it certainly is a continuing problem. The problem of theft from passenger luggage is a continuing one, and it's a very serious one. There are lots of examples of that all across the country. Clearly, the vast majority of aviation workers, I think, are honest people. They're not terrorists. They're not criminals. But all too often, there are some who are criminals and who do steal. Now, generally, that's just a crime problem. But it, as you point out, implicitly, it certainly could be a terrorist problem. But we can't afford an either-or approach. We can't just focus on theft and focus on baggage and not focus on passengers as well. Both are potential vulnerabilities, so we need to screen luggage, we need to screen cargo, we need to screen passengers. We need better intelligence and law enforcement. So we need a concerted and coordinated and complementary approach to all these things at the same time.
All right, let's talk with someone in Chicago. This is line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you got real close to the problem here, which is, once again, what's being done is put in these corporations instead of what's in the interests of most of the American people. I mean, airline industry has been subsidized by the government day one. Airline industry has never made money. It's always been a failing industry. They need to pay the full bill. We got to stop subsidizing them. All of this stuff is being paid for the federal government. In terms of security for them, as a subsidy for them. Let them pay for it. If it gets too expensive to fly, maybe the free market will actually start to work and people will take an alternative means. Maybe, finally, rail would become a more logical, cheaper way to get around the country. It never will be as long as the airlines are getting a free handout from the government. It's welfare for the rich, once again, and nothing in the interest of the people.
Well, Mr. Irvin, you want to comment on that?
Sure. Well, I agree with that in part, you know, and I've essentially said this, that I think all too often the Department of Homeland Security and its components, TSA being a perfect example, have bent over backwards unduly to accommodate the interests of industry. And I say that, by the way, again, I want to stress my political credentials because I think it gives greater credibility to what I say. As a Republican, as a conservative, I'm generally supportive of business. I don't want to bankrupt the airline industry or any other industry. It's the genius, it's the dynamism of America that our private sector is as dynamic as it is. And so we need to be careful in terms of regulation and expense. But on the other hand, the primary thing ought always to be security. And when the two imperatives, security and economic viability are in conflict, I put my money literally on security. Now, that said, I am not arguing that the entire cost of aviation security should be borne by the airline industry. At the end of the day, this is a national security issue, and because it's a national security issue, I think ultimately it is a cost that should be borne by the nation, by all of us. And so, sure, I'm for some user fees, and there are some user fees on airline tickets that pay in part for security programs, but it seems to me that the cost ought to be widely shared by all of us Americans, whether we take aviation or not, because the impact of another 9/11 style attack on aviation would affect not just those of us, and of course nowadays it's most of us, who use air travel all the time. It would affect the nation as a whole.
Yeah. Let me, since the caller raised the issue of other kinds of transportation, not in this context, but it's certainly one of the things that I want to talk about, and I know that you have concerns about as well. It's some of the terrorist incidents that we have seen, number of them we have seen in other places outside the United States, have involved mass transit, or at least they've involved trains. And we have not seen anything like that here, but I know that, again, for you, mass transit is a concern as well, that we have big city trains and subway systems, and we have cross-country rail in this country, and those are, I'm not sure what sort of security, if there is much, any security in place for those systems now.
Right. Well, you're quite right, David. I am very concerned about that. And again, not to keep talking about money, but it's important to draw a contrast. As I said earlier, we spend $18 to $20 billion on aviation security by way, and we've still got great problems there, despite that expenditure. But that said, we're far better off there than anywhere else, as I've also emphasized. By way of contrast, we're spending only about $250 million since 9/11 to secure the mass transit sector, even though some 33 million people use mass transit every day all across the country to get to work, to go to recreation, places of worship, whatever. And that's 16 times the number of people who use air travel every day. So if you just do the numbers, it's more important that we invest in mass transit than in aviation. And as you noted, we've had at least a couple scares, major scares, as to the vulnerability of our own mass transit systems. The Madrid bombing in the spring of 2004, the London subway bombings in the summer of 2005, and then there have been a number of plots that have been foiled and uncovered with regard to the subway system in New York City, for example. Now, the good news is, after every one of those scares, as your listeners may recall, it seems to me the federal government and applicable state and local governments have done all the right things. You've seen in those in the applicable cities increased armed police presence, more bomb-sniffing dogs, greater use of bomb sensors and public awareness campaigns. And in New York and New Jersey and Salt Lake City, there was even random bag searches for a time, as you'll recall. And that's the good news. The bad news is that every time those scares faded from the headlines, all those measures were either done away with altogether or they were ratcheted back. If I were a terrorist, I'd watch that, and I'd just wait until the measures were relaxed before striking. What needs to happen is there needs to be armed police, there need to be random searches, there needs to be sensors and public awareness, all these things, on an ongoing institutionalized basis. The reason why that isn't done is because it costs money. And again, just underscores how important it is to spend significantly more money on Homeland Security.
Well, just to stay with that for a second, earlier we made the point that perhaps as far as screening airline passengers is concerned, the issue there is not technology, the issue there is money, what it would spend to implement the technologies. Is it the case that here if we're talking about something like a big city subway system where we move very large numbers of people, and the people have to get where they're going, and they have to get there quickly, and you know, you're dealing with people going to work and people trying to get home, that it would actually be possible to do a kind of a passenger screening, or maybe just some kind of remote sensing or proximity sensing so that you could tell whether somebody had explosives. It would actually be possible to do that and not compromise the ability of the system to move people the way that we expect it to do?
Well, yes and no. I don't think that we could do any kind of passenger screening in an efficient way. I do think it would bring mass transit travel to a screeching halt. We can't do that. There have been pilot programs to test it, and the tests have shown what one would expect, that they create just intolerable bottlenecks. On the other hand, as you say, the sensor idea makes a lot of sense. We can have these sensors that would at least detect explosives in the air that could prevent major explosive tragedies, and so we need that widely deployed, and that could easily be done, but it's a question of cost.
Let's talk with another listener in Lovington. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I guess my comment may be a little bit off the travel type things and security as far as moving stuff around, but it seems to me, looking at some of these things, and you're talking about numbers, and I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are, but it seems to me like almost the main impact of 9/11 we've kind of done to ourselves by wasting a lot of this money. And I gave you an example. I'm on a fire department. We were all issued gas masks. Well, we have no idea what to do with them. One of the fellows I'm on with made the comment, you know, I can put this on and watch my family die. What else, you know, what else do we do with this stuff? It looks to me like it was a major sales deal for the gas mask company. And I guess
well,
wonder
that's
what you think about the numbers on that.
I know that that's something, Mr. Evan, that you've been during the time that you were there as the Inspector General, you voiced some real concerns about the fact that money had been spent, but you thought that there were certainly cases where money was spent badly.
That's right. I'm very glad that the caller raised that. It's a very important issue. Yes, it's the case that we need to have significantly more money for Homeland Security, but one of the reasons why we're unlikely to get significantly more money anytime soon anyway is because all too often the Department of Homeland Security has wasted the billions of dollars that have been given to it in examples like the one that the caller cited. Unfortunately, it is still the case to a large degree that funds from the Department of Homeland Security for preparedness, to make us better prepared against next terrorist attack, given to states and cities and to first responder communities, police, fire, emergency medical personnel, have been divvied up around the country on a pork barrel basis, a little bit for every state and locality, irrespective of the likelihood that a given state or locality is under a terrorist threat. It seems to me that the bulk of the funds should be given to cities like New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Chicago in your area, and others that, because they're major population centers, are necessarily at the top of the terrorist target list. And yet, for example, in the latest round of counterterrorism funding sent out by the Department of Homeland Security, came out last fall, just 2 or 3 months ago, there was a 40% cut given to New York and Washington, D.C., and there's a significant increase to smaller cities. Omaha, Nebraska comes to mind, and others that are, by any measure, much less likely to face a terrorist attack than these major cities. So one of the things the 9/11 Commission recommended some years ago was that there be 100% funding, counterterrorism funding, on the basis of risk and threat. And I am a strong proponent of that, and if that were to be the case, then funds would be allocated in that fashion, and we'd be safer as a result.
And I noticed you didn't bring up one word that maybe you're reluctant to because of this area, but all the funding that's going for agro-terrorism. I think the likelihood of terrorists striking our fields is very low. Just it'd be impossible to do a whole lot to these thousands and millions of acres of crops around here, and there's a lot of money being trying to get channeled that way. But I'll hang up. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I actually disagree with that, I have to say. I do think that there is a threat, a significant threat, a serious one, with regard to agro-terrorism, bioterrorism. It would be very easy to poison America's food supply. We've seen the impact of that, or the potential impact of that, with these bovine scares that we've had from time to time, mad cow disease, that kind of thing, in this country and other countries. That would be a relatively cost-free, relatively cheap way, if pathogens were introduced into our food supply, to kill a lot of people and also to scare a lot more. And, of course, you know, the first part of terrorism, part of the root of that is terrorize. The whole point of terrorism is to scare people. You want to kill and you want to injure as many people as you possible, and you want to scare the wits out of the rest. And so, you know, as opposed to carrying off another 9/11 style attack, which is not impossible, but it's pretty hard to do, poisoning the food supply, poisoning the water supply is relatively easy to do. So I disagree with the caller. I think that's a serious threat that has not been taken seriously enough by the Department of Homeland Security.
Let me take a moment here to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking this morning with Clark Irvin. He is the director of the Homeland Security Initiative at the Aspen Institute. They're interested in looking at various issues related to Homeland Security, assess the progress that's been made so far, and develop some recommendations for making America safer. He was the first Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. He also has served as Inspector General of the Department of State and the Broadcasting Board of Governors. He also held a number of posts in the state of Texas in state government there. He served as the Assistant Secretary of State and also as the Deputy Attorney General. He is the author of the book Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack, published by Palgrave Macmillan. That book came out last May, if you would like to read it. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned a couple of times that you were appointed by President Bush and that you served out a term as the Inspector General up until December of 2004, I believe, and they declined to reappoint you. And I know that I have read some things about you, and do you really believe that perhaps the reason that you were not reappointed to this post was that you did your job too well?
Well, the brief answer to that is yes, that clearly is part of it. But just to be ultra precise, as I always try to be, really, ultimately, I was not allowed to continue to serve in this job because of opposition from both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, from ultimately the White House and also from Congress, but mostly Congress. The Inspector General of federal departments and agencies, like most high-level presidential appointees, all of them really, have to ultimately be approved, confirmed by the Senate in order to stay in their jobs. I was allowed to become the acting inspector general at the Department of Homeland Security at the very beginning of the department in January 03, as you noted, because there was a special provision in the Homeland Security law that allowed those officials who had already been confirmed in similar positions to take up their duties at the Department of Homeland Security in an acting capacity pending confirmation. That the White House promptly submitted my nomination to the Senate in January of 03, and I got a very quick hearing from the applicable Senate committee, then called the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, chaired by Republican Susan Collins of Maine, and the ranking Democrat at the time was Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, who's now the chairman to be. But unfortunately, I got opposition from both Senators Collins and Lieberman. Neither one of them ever permitted the rest of their committee members to consider my nomination. And because of that, to the president's credit, the White House's credit, they gave me what's called a recess appointment, as you noted at the beginning, which at the end of 03, which allowed me to serve as the inspector general, no longer acting. That was the good news. The bad news is those appointments are temporary. They allow presidents to bypass the Senate for a temporary period of time. And then the nomination was resubmitted to the Senate at the beginning of the next year, 2004, and the hope was that I'd be confirmed then. I wasn't confirmed in 2004 either, by which time at the end of 04, the end of the congressional term, my recess appointment expired, and the White House at that point chose not to resubmit my nomination because I believe by then, after 2 years of rather critical reports on aviation security and other aspects of Homeland Security, I think ultimately the White House concluded that my reports were not in the best political interest of the administration. So it really is a bad news story on Congress's part, mostly, because had I been confirmed either in 03 or 04 by Senator Collins, who had it within her power to do so, I'd be the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security today with no need for the White House to resubmit my nomination for approval.
Yeah. The idea behind the Department of creation of the Department of Homeland Security was to take various branches of the government that, one way or another were responsible for some aspect of, national security and bring them into one agency. And there was a lot of controversy early on where when this was first discussed, one of the big questions was whether or not the FBI and the CIA should be a part of it. And it turned out ultimately they're not there. But certainly there are a lot of government functions that now came together here. This was the biggest government reorganization in half a century since the Department of Defense was created. So this was an enormous undertaking. How successful do you think, if the idea was that we want to try to unify under one umbrella different agencies that are responsible for different aspects of Homeland Security, maybe make a more efficient, for more oversight, for better communication between the various parts? If those things were the goal, how successful has it been?
Not successful at all, I have to say, David, and I say that with no joy at all. Essentially, as I say in my book, Open Target, the Department of Homeland Security is simply a collection of variously dysfunctional agencies tied together only by a common name, logo, and organization chart. The Department of Homeland Security is not an integrated organization where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And that's really because of a number of things. One is money, which I've stressed throughout the course of this talk, but also leadership, really. You know, the first Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security is a wonderful human being, and I worked with him, the first Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge. But he was a classic politician, and by that, most politicians don't have any training whatsoever in managing large organizations, and most politicians aren't trained counterterrorism experts, and yet that's what the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security should have been, someone who had experience in dealing with, as you said, the largest reorganization of the federal government in more than 50 years. The closest parallel was the reorganization of the Defense Department, the modern Defense Department, in 1947. And, you know, that didn't come together to work more or less correctly until the 1990s, some 50 years later, really, even though the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines pretty much do the same thing. They fight wars and prepare to fight wars, whereas in the Department of Homeland Security, you've got organizations as disparate as the Coast Guard and the Secret Service. And all of the 22 different components of the Department of Homeland Security, as I said, were dysfunctional to one degree or another before the department was brought together. So, and it was put together so hastily, it was just done in a matter of months in the year 2002 in response to the terror attacks in 2001, that their time wasn't taken to correct these dysfunctions. So what you had is these dysfunctions compounding each other in what I call in the book a pathological symbiosis of dysfunction.
Hmm. Just if we could to return to, we're moving into about our last 10, 15 minutes here, to return to one specific issue. We were talking a little bit earlier about some specific security concerns. We've talked a little bit about commercial aviation. We talked a little bit about mass transit. Another big concern, and yours, and I know a lot of other people's as well, has to do with commercial shipping. And particularly containers. Every day in this country, big ships dock at ports that are loaded with enormous shipping containers. Only a small percentage of these are ever inspected. And this, I think, is a major point of concern. I think people are concerned about the possibility that a weapon of mass destruction might be introduced in the United States. It seems that the big concern is not someone who's going to lob a missile at us or fly over the United States in a plane and drop something. It's that's going to come in this way. It's a tremendous vulnerability. What are we doing to address that, and how could we address it better?
Well, right now, you're quite right. It's a major vulnerability. In fact, I would argue that it's the major vulnerability. All the experts agree that the number one threat to this country is nuclear terrorism. And with that as a predicate, all the experts further agree that the likeliest way, or most experts, the likeliest way for a nuclear weapon to make its way into our country will be through one of our 361 seaports aboard one of the 11 million cargo containers that comes into those seaports every year. And yet we're inspecting only about 6% of those incoming cargo containers for radiation. And what that means, of course, is we don't know anything about the other 94%. And even the 6% that we are inspecting, there's problems there because our basis for picking that 6% figure is flawed. Basically, it's based on the cargo manifest, what the shipper claims the cargo contains, when it's very easy to manipulate that. And further, you can legally change the cargo manifest for up to 60 days after the cargo arrives to the United States, believe it or not. And also shipping route, which again is very easy to manipulate. You can claim that it originates from France when in fact it originates from a high threat area like Saudi Arabia or Indonesia or Pakistan, for example. And then finally, the radiation detection equipment that we have, we don't have enough of it, and the equipment that we have isn't all that good. All too often it can't distinguish between radiation that occurs naturally in harmless things like bananas or kitty litter, and then the harmful kind of radiation that can kill people. So it's a real concern. Now, the good news is we're making progress. There is technology that can pinpoint the source of radiation and distinguish between deadly and harmless radiation. And the good news further is that there is a pilot program in Hong Kong, which is the world's busiest port, where there's 100% inspection of cargo containers for radiation, and that is done relatively cheaply at a cost of about $20 per cargo container, and it's done quickly without unduly slowing down commerce, upon which, of course, the world economy depends. And the further good news is, and I say this as a Republican, the incoming Democrats in the House and Senate have pledged to move quickly toward a 100% cargo inspection regime. And because of some pressure, Secretary Chertoff, the Department of Homeland Security, is moving in that direction. So we're not going to get to 100% inspection overnight, but we're moving in that direction and not a minute too soon, it seems to me, because as you say, it is the major vulnerability facing this country.
Back at the beginning of the program, I asked this as a general kind of a question to start us off about whether we were more secure than we were before September 11th. And you said, well, yes. But then if you ask the question, are we as safe as we can be, want to be, should be, you would say the answer to the questions is no. And I wonder, you know, people, I think, make quite a bit of, some people make quite a bit of the fact that since September 11th, there has been no successful terrorist attack here in the United States. There have been attempts, and you also talked about the fact that just this past summer, the business with the liquids and the airplanes, that was perhaps a near miss, that we came very close, and through the diligence of intelligence in Britain, that plot was blocked. When someone says to you, well, doesn't the fact that we have had no attacks since September 11th mean that our anti-terrorism efforts are successful? How do you answer a question like that?
I'm glad that you asked that, David. That's a real key question. And in particular, I think it's important to answer that question for those who aren't experts in counterterrorism, because I can understand the average person hearing people in the administration, people in the Department of Homeland Security say, look, we must be doing something right. After all, we haven't been attacked in more than 5 years. Actually, it seems to me that that's as much, and this may sound odd, and I'll explain what I mean, it's as much a bad news story, really, as a good news story. Of course it's a good thing, and thank God we haven't had another terror attack, but that does not mean we're out of the woods. You know, every other month or so, there's another videotape, audio tape from bin Laden himself or from his number two deputy, Zawahiri. We just had one from him a week or so ago during the holiday period, threatening another attack against the United States. So we know that terrorists remain intent on attacking the United States. And as I said before, the government's own investigations show how easy it is to carry out a terrorist attack despite the progress we've made since 9/11. So terrorists are capable of carrying out a terrorist attack. So the only reason why we haven't had one, it seems to me, is because terrorists want the next attack to be at least as spectacular and ideally even more spectacular than the last one. And the more grandiose your ambitions as a terrorist, the harder it is to carry out, the more operatives you need, the more money it costs, the greater it is that something will go awry. So it's the scale of terrorist ambitions and not the difficulty of carrying out a terrorist attack that is the issue, it seems to me. If terrorists, for example, wanted to send a suicide bomber into a restaurant or a nightclub, as happens all the time in Israel or Indonesia or other countries around the world, that could be done very easily indeed, but they haven't done that again because, and they've said this on the record, they want spectacular attacks, and it's a little harder to do something spectacular than it is to do something that is de minimis. So I'm not suggesting, and I want to stress this as well, that if we were to do everything that I recommend, we would be invulnerable to terrorist attack. We could implement all my recommendations and we'd be hit by terrorists tomorrow. But what I am saying is that what we need to do is everything we possibly can do to make ourselves as invulnerable to attack as we can be, and we have yet to do that. And because we have not yet done that, we are in mortal peril, and we're far more vulnerable than we have to be.
We have a couple of minutes left here. Let us suppose that we're going to give you Mike Chertoff's job. We're going to make you the head of Department of Homeland Security. If we did that, what would be the major things that you would do right away? Well, maybe not right away, but you would say, okay, this is what we really need to concentrate on now.
Well, gosh, there's so many things, David, that's really kind of tough to answer. But let me give you just three things. One is, as I say, we need to go to 100% cargo inspection just as quickly as we possibly can. I mean that in the port context, seaport context. Second, we need to do 100% inspection of air cargo, which we also talked about earlier. As I mentioned, there's a pilot program in Hong Kong to show how feasible it is to do seaport radiation inspections. There's a pilot in Britain, the Netherlands, and Israel. There's 100% inspection of air cargo, so there's precedent for doing air cargo inspections as well. That, too, is feasible, and it ought to be done. The third thing is the visa waiver program. This is a little complicated, but just quickly, there are 27 countries in the world, mostly in Europe. We have such good relationships, and people from those countries so rarely overstay their visas that we allow people from those countries to visit the United States for up to 90 days for tourism or business or study without being required to obtain a visa. And in exchange for that, when we Americans go to those countries, we don't have to get visas to visit those countries. That's certainly good from a tourism business perspective, but it's a potential security threat because there's much less scrutiny, obviously, given to somebody who doesn't need a visa than somebody who does need a visa, because if you do need a visa, you have to go to our embassies and consulates abroad, and you're pretty extensively scrutinized now in the post-9/11 environment. I think we need to do away with the visa waiver program. That's a controversial recommendation. I say that as someone who's a fervent internationalist. There'd be a lot of international backlash against that. We'd lose the ability to travel to these countries freely. But I'm for that because terrorists steal passports from visa waiver countries for a reason. It's not surprising that the shoe bomber Richard Reed came from Britain on a British passport, that Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker on 9/11, came on a French passport. And that's because, again, they were able to escape the scrutiny that comes from not having to travel on a visa. And yet, the president, when he was in the Baltics a couple months ago, proposed expanding the visa waiver program to allow still more countries' citizens to visit our country without visas. So those three things could be done fairly quickly. The last thing, ending the visa waiver program, could be done with a stroke of a pen this afternoon if the president were inclined to do that. We're moving in the wrong direction there. And God forbid, if there's a terrorist attack involving people coming from visa waiver countries, we'll take that step. The question is, can we take it now before we have to?
And then also, I expect that you would be, in your first opportunity, you'd be on Capitol Hill asking the Congress for more money.
I absolutely would. There's no question about that. And with Democrats in charge, I think we're likely to get more money.
Well, I suppose that is an open question, because the Democrats certainly have voiced their concerns in these areas, and have also talked about the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, and said that they would like to more aggressively try to implement some of those. Do you think that that's actually likely to happen?
Yes, I do. I do think that. I do. The Democrats have said that. They're on record as having said that. Even when they were in opposition, they were pushing very aggressively for implementing all those recommendations and for devoting more money to Homeland Security and for exercising more vigorous oversight over the Department of Homeland Security. And so I expect that all of that will happen, and that is all to the good.
All right. Well, there we must stop, because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest is Clark Ervin. He's the director of the Homeland Security Initiative at the Aspen Institute, and also served as the first Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Ervin, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, David. Thank you for having me.
Also, I guess I should mention once again his book, Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack. Paul Grabe McMillan, the publisher on the book, and it just came out this past May of 2006.